Well, next hour, we talk a little bit of metaphysics and the paranormal, but for the rest of this hour, it's real science. We'll take your calls next. And welcome back. We are back with Leonard Mlodinow as we talk about his work, The Upright Thinkers, and that would be us, would it not, Leonard?
It is.
When mankind started to truly get into science, there was a dramatic change, an evolution of knowledge. I remember the 1900s, of course, historically, the things that were going on then. Then all of a sudden, things just exploded. Not too long later. How did that happen?
Well, it was the ability for us to understand and be able to control atoms and molecules and electrons. And that came from our quantum theory, which was developed between 1900 and about 1925. That was the basis of it. And after 1925, we knew enough to start applying it. And in the next just couple decades, the computer was invented, the digital computer was invented, and transistor, and then integrated circuits. And by the 60s, the explosion of technology started to happen. And that eventually led to explosion in knowledge, and that fed on other technologies, and it really, really took off, you know, after the internet came in the 90s, and give it another 10 years for that to develop, and then in the last 10 years, it's been just crazy.
And the smartphones, all that now.
The smartphone, 2007 was the touchscreen, the iPhone, and look at it, it seems like ancient now, doesn't it? I mean, can you remember back before there were smartphones and touchscreens? It seems like it was ancient, but it was 9 years ago. That shows you know, it was 1963, I think, that touch tone phones came out. People used to have the rotary phones before that.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until the 1980s, 20 years later, that the majority of Americans had a touch tone phone. So it took 20 years for the majority to get them, right? And the iPhone, and within 5 years, BlackBerry was history, right? I mean, BlackBerry had a 50% market share when the iPhone came out, and within 5 years, it was 2%.
I thought it was so cool, Leonard, when I had the Motorola phone that looked like it came off an Army base.
Yeah.
You remember that one?
Yeah, I do, yeah. Well, that was really cool at that time. But that's what I'm thinking. I mean, if you go 10 years from now, I'm sure that voice control is getting really good. And that's the next big thing, I think, in that kind of technology. You'll tell your refrigerator, lower your temperature. You don't have to do anything. Just say it. Refrigerator, lower your temperature. It's like on Star Trek. Because once voice recognition technology gets really good, and not just the recognition, but the understanding, and gets incorporated into devices all over your house, you won't have to type anymore. Already, I use some, when I write my books, I write a fair amount of it using voice transcription. So I just say it into a software, and it types it for me. But, you know, in everyday life, that's going to be more and more common now. So you'll just say, car, start. Of course, the car's going to be driving itself by then anyway. Maybe the car will tell you, get in, it's time to go.
Get in, or get out.
Well, they're also talking about these technologies that are going to understand what you need, what you want, be able to communicate with you, make suggestions to you. A very simple thing would be to keep your calendar and say, hey, George, it's time to go to work. And you'll get in the car, it'll drive you there. You won't have to say a thing.
Who's the drunk driver if you don't drive? What if you jump into your car, you're inebriated, but are you the drunk driver?
Well, that's a question I've heard spoken of both in legal and ethical circles, because you need to be there to supervise it. Can you have a drink? I don't know. That's past my pay grade.
If your car runs over a pedestrian, can you be sued?
Good question.
I wasn't driving.
I wasn't driving. Yeah, my Google car made me do it. I don't know.
I mean, that's an interesting take on things. I mean, somebody's walking across a pedestrian walkway, across the road, your car, you may be in the back seat, you're not driving, your car smashes into them for some reason and kills the poor guy or woman. It's not your fault, you weren't driving.
Well, you know, these are the kinds of questions that are going to pepper us more and more as all these new technologies come to play. I mean, you think that's a hard one. What about the one where someone, you know, designs a new creature and it gets away and starts killing people?
Oh,
what?
Exactly. You know? That. Or even if two cars collide and there are no drivers.
And there are no drivers, yeah.
Who's going to argue?
Amazing. Well, the better lawyer always wins.
Yeah, that's true, too. That is true. As you look at science, and we're going to go to calls are lining up for you like crazy. As you look at the future of science, would you say it was the computer that was the most remarkable change that affected all this?
Well, in terms of our understanding, people don't even realize how much of our advances are the computer. You asked me earlier about LIGO, the gravitational wave detector. No way you get anything like that without computers. We talked about CRISPR, the gene splicing. No understanding of the genome without computers. People don't even realize, but scientists live and breathe computers today. And if you just took them away, it'd be like taking away writing. It's such a basic.
Or their right hand.
Or their right hand. If you're a theorist, it's like taking away writing. If you're an experimentalist, it's like taking away your right hand.
Yeah, no, you're. What would Einstein have been able to do, Leonard, today with the use of full computers?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Of course, we look at Einstein as one of the greatest geniuses of all time, who really changed physics in many ways. But he lived in a time where there were certain fundamental questions that were open, and people didn't realize it, but there were some paradoxes or some contradictions in the existing theories at that time, and he straightened that out. Today, those questions don't seem to be there. Of course, maybe not until the new Einstein comes to tell me, but if they don't seem, it seems to be a much different atmosphere. And of course, using computers is a totally different skill than what Einstein had. So, he'd be a really smart guy. I'm just not sure if Einstein would be Einstein today.
That would be an interesting take. He might even push it aside and say, I don't need one of these.
He was not the type to use one, but the question is, what would he be working on, and would there be that potential that he had? And he happened to live in just a really good time for revolutionizing physics.
I think he'd be amazed at the mathematical speed of a computer.
Oh, I would be amazed at everything about a computer, yeah. Of course. Yeah. Yes, in those days, I think it was the abacus.
That's right.
Slide rules.
Slide rules, too. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Let's go to the Big Island in Hawaii. Jim is with us, west of the Rockies. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. Good evening, George.
Hey, Jim.
I just would like to ask a question.
Sure.
That a friend of mine, a fellow disabled veteran, once told me that the universe, the Hubble Space Telescope discovered that the universe started from a mass of less than one atom. Now, if that is true, that would support your theory that universes can come from nothing. And then the absolute truth versus the relative truth of Buddhism is that absolute truth is emptiness. So nothing in emptiness is the source of all things. So is that really true that the Hubble discovered that the universe started from the mass of less than one atom?
Unfortunately, no, it's not. And the Hubble can't even see that far back into the history of the universe. If you go back in time, the energy and matter that was in the universe still existed. It was just in a smaller and smaller area or volume. And if you go back far enough, it would have been in a volume less than one atom. Maybe that's what your friend was referring to, but it's not really the kind of stuff that Hubble can look back into.
Leonard, if you were able to develop a device, a telescope, something that could go back and see the first light of the Big Bang, the so-called Big Bang, the first light of it, would it be conceivable what would happen if we developed something that could see beyond that? And I wonder what it would be. All darkness? Who knows?
Yes, I'd say who
knows?
Who knows? Yeah, we don't really. No, I think we do a good job going back to about maybe 10 to the minus 30th seconds of the universe, which is pretty darn small, pretty early. But it's pushing it to try and get back to, zero.
It really
and,
is.
You know, they have to keep in mind also that this is, I'm saying this, when physicists talk like that, like I am now, it's all, you have to take it with a grain of salt, too, because remember that time and space were very much intertwined back then. So because the universe was in such a small area, it doesn't really make, it's not literally make a lot of sense to talk about time as a separate dimension. It would have been impossible to separate time and the dimensions of space. So even our, you know, that's the way we think about it because of the way our minds are, but it's, you know, that itself is a stretch.
Are you a believer in time travel?
Well, it's certainly easy enough to travel forward in time. And, you know, as they popularized in the movie that Kip Thorne worked on, Interstellar, physics tells us that if you go near a black hole and you come back, your time and the people, the time of the people that you left will have passed, much greater time would have passed for the people that you left than for you. So you could go and spend, you know, within 10 years, go near a black hole and come back, and it could be 1,000 years for the people you left behind. And that is established physics. And so if we had a black hole nearby, we could do that. How you can do it without is another question. But theoretically, moving forward in time is easy. Moving backward in time is another question. And people talk about whether there could be these things called wormholes that would let you do that. But again, that's great. It's solid science speculation, but the existence of wormholes is probably don't exist. And who knows if you could ever figure out how to make one. It sounds doubtful to me, but it's not impossible. So,
Leonard, my simple way of time travel is to get on a plane and go into different time zones, forward or backward. It is. It's time traveling. You know, if you leave at 11 o'clock in the morning and you get there at 9 o'clock in the morning or whatever, you're traveling.
Yes, you are. And, you know, you can time travel by going to certain places. I was just in the Czech Republic, and they seem about 20 years behind us in terms of society is over there. So that's the kind of time travel, too.
Cuba stopped in the 1960s, I think.
That's right. If you go to, and I was in Cuba a while back, I think, hopefully beyond the statute of limitations now that I've said that. But yes, it was like going to like an old Humphrey Bogart.
They still have the old cars, the 60 cars, and I'm told still bullet holes from the revolution in walls and stuff like that.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? So, that, you know, that's a cultural time travel.
Let's go to Claudia, Joshua Tree, California. Claudia, good morning. You're up. Hello there.
Good morning. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead,
Claudia. Hi. George, I'd like to thank you again for what you and Tommy did for me in getting me to the...
You are very welcome. You don't have to thank us. It was our pleasure.
Well, anyway, thank you. It's the first time I'd been anywhere in over 40 years rubbing elbows, as they say, with celebrities. Last time was at a Thalian show in Hollywood.
Did you have a good time?
Yes, I did.
Okay, good.
Yes, I did. Leonard... Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Is that his name, Leonard?
That is.
I wrote it down.
That's his name.
Once I saw a picture of the things, the creatures that live in our eyebrows, I think it was magnified 5,000 times, I always wondered, what lives in their eyebrows? Do you think?
Bacteria.
Bacteria, and in the bacteria, do you think that maybe they can't possibly be living in the same dimension as we are, even if they are living in our heads. Let's see in the...
It's the same. They have different dimensions, but they live in the same dimensions. Excuse my pun.
Elon Musk says that we may be living in a matrix-type existence, some computerized program that has created us. I hope nobody deletes us.
Yeah, really. Oh.
But even the wonders of life, have you come up with your own theories on just what this is, why we're here, what it all means, without getting spiritual or religious?
Well, I find it a comfort to think that we are, you know, all natural phenomena, that, you know, we're made of atoms that have no soul or no thoughts, no consciousness, just zillions, trillions, zillions of atoms. And as a collective, they somehow form a certain order that gives us these conscious thoughts, and it's like a miracle to me. But to see myself as part of nature, like a rock or a tree, is very comforting. You don't take too seriously, you're grateful that for the feelings and the love and the consciousness that you have, and you also accept that it's going to, you know, end at some point, just like everything else does, and the whole earth is going to be swallowed up by the sun in a couple billion years, and it's all part of nature. So I guess that Disney called it the circle of life, but I'm making it a bigger circle, the circle of the universe. And to me, apart from religion, that is something I take comfort in.
I used to get so upset in school when our teacher would say, the sun's going to burn out. And of course, he would say in billions of years, but I'd go home and talk to my folks about it, and I was clearly upset. I said, the sun's going to burn out. And my dad and my mom would say, I think it's going to be in billions of years, George. Don't worry about that.
It's a long way away, right? But
a little kid just didn't put it together at that point.
No, it's hard. But I think as you understand it, it gives you a framework or a structure, and in some ways, I guess it makes you feel insignificant. But in a way, that's good, because I don't exaggerate my importance. I just have a good time.
Leonard, when you look at the pace of knowledge, why is it that we still cannot figure out how the Egyptians, if they did it, made the pyramids? How they moved the blocks, how they truly did it. I mean, there have been theories that abound everywhere, but I mean, we really don't specifically know how they did it. Were they smarter than we were?
They had far less knowledge, but they did have thousands of slaves, and maybe that had something to do with it. It's maybe amazing what you can do if you have unlimited labor and you don't care whether they get hurt or don't have to pay them. That's my theory.
Yeah.
Whenever I go to great cathedrals of Europe, you know, I look at them and people talk about how beautiful they are, and I just think of all the poor people who have to build them and climb up 100 feet with a 10-ton rock and fell off the ladder, you know. I think it is, it's mind-boggling to see what they did in the ancient times. And I'm not an expert on what the theories are about how they did it, but to me it does seem miraculous. And the only thing, I mean, as I said, what I can think of is that with unlimited labor, you can get a lot done, I guess.
Leonard also was the co-author with Stephen King in A Brief History of Time as well. We're going to come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM and take your final phone calls, so don't touch your dial. Well, our novel is out, Night Talk. You can find it on Amazon.com. There's a link at coasttocoastam.com, and it's quickly going up the rankings. It's kind of fun to watch it go from 10 million to wherever it is right now. Night Talk, and it's a great novel about a talk show host who deals with conspiracies. Okay, welcome back to Coast, our final segment with Leonard Mlodinow now as we talk about his latest work, The Upright Thinkers. Leonard, is science and religion or spirituality at odds, or are they very close?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because even though today people make a lot about the conflicts between the two, they really started in the same place. They started thousands of years ago when people started asking questions about our place in the universe and what is life and what is death. And throughout history, until just very recently, most of the greatest thinkers were very religious, and they viewed their science as a way of getting at the mind of God. You know, Newton was a religious man. Boyle and the other people who invented modern chemistry were religious. Even Charles Darwin, I mean, today people talk about evolution as if it's the anti-Bible, but Charles Darwin was a religious man, and he was going to go into the clergy, and when he started his theory of evolution, he still believed in Christianity. So I think it's a modern and maybe not necessary tension between science and spirituality, and the two can really coexist. They really are two different ways of looking at the same questions.
And when religious folks, I think about the Vatican and, you know, their observatories and their real strong influence with science. Do you find that to be weird?
No, I mean, historically, the church supported the early universities, and that's where science really took off in Europe. That's one reason that modern science was really invented in Europe and not in India or Asia, or I should say other parts of Asia or the Arab world. So the church has played, in many ways, a constructive role in science. And, you know, even Galileo, who people are usually taught, you know, was tried and convicted of heresy for preaching that the Earth orbited the sun rather than the old view, right, with the Earth at the center of the universe. But that's not really what he was convicted of. What they really didn't like was that he preached a vision of the world without getting it okayed by the church. So it was really a battle over power of who gets to say what happened, not really so much a battle over what the universe is like. And had he played his politics differently, he would have been fine.
All right, let's go back to the calls. Let's go to Bill, truck driving in Indiana. Hi, Bill. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Leonard. Hey, George.
Hi there.
Hey, I got a question about this ethical discussion concerning CRISPR-Cas9 use in producing human tissue or organs for replacement.
Mm-hmm.
Is it? Let's say you use CRISPR-Cas9 to edit a pig DNA to produce, like, a human, something as simple as a human outer ear. Could that possibly lead to a pig manifesting a human-like, more complex brain?
No, I don't think there would be a connection there, but, you know, there are, once you start doing these manipulations, there are going to be gray areas where it's a little bit closer. For instance, you know, you may want to grow a part of an actual human brain in a pig to replace something that, I don't know, that got damaged in a stroke or who knows what. You might want to grow nerves to replace human nerves that have been damaged. Or, I mean, there are going to be many issues come up where you get, you know, in that particular example, it doesn't seem like too much of a gray area, but I'm sure there will be gray areas. Or you may want to actually grow a part of a human. Instead of doing it on a pig, suppose that the best way to do it is to grow a little human embryo that maybe doesn't have all its parts there. Maybe you're just growing the part of the human, and, you know, for purpose of harvesting, you're never going to really let it get to maturity or even to birth, but you're going to take some embryonic part of it, or who knows what. There are. It's easy to see where you can run into ethical issues.
Fast too.
Yeah.
When you were writing Uptight Thinkers, did you come across anything that you found to be controversial?
Well, I mean, a lot of the ideas that were forwarded through the ages that I describe in the book were controversial at the time, and people had a hard time accepting it. One thing I learned in writing the book was that at the time, things that seem obvious now and not controversial seemed, even to the people who were inventing the ideas, to be controversial or to be hard to accept. People didn't even understand what they were doing themselves, and it's only with time that we get to understand what people did in the past, and then when we teach it, we make it seem as if they knew it right then. But, for instance, the founders of quantum theory in the early 20th century argued amongst themselves constantly, turned on each other, thought each other's version or contributions were BS, and fought constantly and didn't really know what they were doing until, you know, years later we've all kind of sorted it all out. So controversy seems to come with it because humans have a hard time accepting new things.
What was the greatest advancement, Leonard, for science? Was it mathematics? Was it the ability to gaze into the heavens? What do you think it was?
For science, I think it was mathematics. And it was created about 3000 BC in the earliest cities in Mesopotamia for the purpose of accounting and taxation. So math was created when the first cities were created, and labor became specialized, and people sometimes owed other people money, and they owed the government for taxes, and there needed to be a way of keeping track of that, and so they invented arithmetic.
And they got it.
Sorry?
And they got it.
And they got it, and the taxes continue. But thank God mathematics has progressed from there, even though the taxation hasn't.
Let's go to Buffalo, New York. John is with us. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good, John.
Great show.
Thank you.
Love your show, George. You're doing a great job, and thanks for your service, bud.
Thank you.
You asked a question previously about the origin of the universe coming from nothing. And I really don't think that's accurate, because I think what they're observing in the Big Bang is the moment in time when the black hole that we exist inside of was formed. They're seeing the event from inside the event horizon instead of outside of it, because basically when a black hole forms, I believe it starts, you know, obviously streaming matter in. But what's happening when the matter streams into the black hole is it's, you know, quickly being accelerated to and past the speed of light because of the gravitational constant of the black hole. So the matter gets ripped apart into its constituent components, which, you know, the particle accelerators have revealed is basically quarks in various states of spin and alignment, or, you know, whatever makes them protons, neutrons, and electrons. So basically, the event horizon of a black hole on the exterior is the highest energetic state that the quarks exist in, and in that state they form a sphere and exhibit close to, you know, maximum gravitational potential. On the inside of the black hole, the quarks are forming space-time, dark energy, and dark matter. The dark matter coming later from the condensing of the dark energy as the space-time expands. Now, we see our universe continuing to expand and accelerate its expansion because the black hole that we're inside of continues to suck matter. So, of course, the universe inside of it is going to expand. And I wanted to know what your guest thought of
that. All right, let's go to the theoretical physicist and get his take on that.
Well, it's interesting. I couldn't quite follow everything. I think that the problem is that when you have a theory like that, you really have to, you know, write it up with the mathematical equations and maybe a few words between them, and in order to make clear exactly what the speaker was saying. So it's hard to comment on that.
What about the black holes, though?
What about
could we be existing inside of one?
I guess we could. I guess we could be, you know, the whole universe could be something inside of a huge, I don't think the density is, I don't know. I would guess not.
When you were on with me about a year ago, we talked a bit about the possibilities of God, what's out there. And I think, if I remember correctly, doesn't Stephen now believe in God?
No.
He does not.
There was some.
Because that went all around the planet.
That he
believed in God.
I haven't asked him, but I believe I judge that to be false.
Boy, did that spread.
Yeah.
Wow.
On the internet.
Let's go to Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut. You will find him to be an atheist and amateur astronomer. There, I beat you to it, Bill.
Yes, thank you, George. Leonard, let me get right to it. For the last 2 years out of 3 years on George Norrie's New Year's Eve show, I always say that this will be the year, whatever year it was, that science, by data-driven experimentation, finally discovers other universes, meaning the multiverse, as well as other dimensions using the Large Hadron Collider. So my two questions involve, A, the LISA spacecraft, laser interferometry space antenna, that relates to gravitational waves, that relates to potentially the multiverse of the universes, and B, the Large Hadron Collider and other dimensions. So question number one, now that we've had the LISA Pathfinder launched by ESA this year, European Space Agency, and has proved out the concept of LISA, the evolved LISA, that is planned to be launched in 2034, do you think that when LISA is launched, and I hope it will be launched much sooner than 2034, at least the LISA spacecraft that would be a space gravity wave detector. In other words, would that be able to detect other universes? Because I think I've read that gravity is the only force that could be travel between universes. Question number two, on other dimensions in our universe, do you think this year, 2016, now that the LHC is up to its, I think, 14 tetra electron volt level, will it be able to detect other dimensions?
Well, good questions. On the first question, LISA will be able to detect gravity waves like LIGO does, but at different frequencies, because it will be a much larger device, because it's different things floating in space and communicating with a much greater separation. But I don't see where that would detect other universes. Now, I think what you were alluding to maybe was Lisa Randall's theory about gravity leaking into other dimensions, which I don't know. I mean, there's no evidence for that. It was an interesting theory about, it must be 20 years ago now, but there really hasn't been evidence for that happening. Whether or not we'll find some surprise measurement that could be interpreted as being some interaction with another universe, I don't know. In terms of the LHC, same answer, really. I don't see any reason to expect that we would. You have to understand that, of course, there are different theories that predict multiverses, and so there's different versions of that. And in most cases, it's not possible to even detect or interact with those other universes. That doesn't mean that the theory doesn't say it's there. We have a theory of our universe, which as a necessary element implies other universes. That's perfectly okay in science, even if we can't observe those other universes. And we would think of them as being real, even if we can't interact with them, because they're demanded by the theory of our own universe. And I think that's what it's the situation that we seem to be in.
Do you think the Large Hadron Collider was worth it, the billions that it cost?
It was, because without knowing whether the Higgs boson existed, we could never really confirm our basic theory of elementary particles. But we do hope that we'll find fundamental physics beyond that. Physicists all expected that we would see that, but that's not the same as seeing it. Now we've seen it, but everyone hopes that there will be some new bizarre observations that will surprise us, and that's what especially theorists, of course, experimentalists are excited to find it. Theorists are excited by the implications because it gives us work to do to figure out what it means.
Let's go to Chase in Santa Monica, California. Hi, Chase. Welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
I got a pretty quick, short question, a little more simple than the other calls, but I'm happy that you brought up Interstellar, because, the whole theory of, the going forward because of gravity, I try to explain that to religious people, and they just blew their mind. And my question is, are we at all, because, throughout human history, we always tried to get from A to B quicker. That's how we've kind of progressed and tried to make things, happen in our society. Are we progressing at all with any type of, warp drive to get from, planet A to planet B faster? And on top of that question, I watched on YouTube, if we go past the speed of light, does time travel faster on Earth than it does when you're actually traveling at that speed?
Does time travel faster on Earth than...
Right. I watched a video on YouTube where if you somehow figure out a way to accelerate faster than the speed of light, like an object or a spacecraft, that when you start traveling at a certain speed, time travels faster on Earth?
Thousands of years would click.
Yeah, well, we don't believe that you can travel faster than light. Now, in general relativity, it is possible with wormholes to end up somewhere else that was kind of a jump, but basically you can't propel yourself to travel faster than light. And in terms of ways to go to do that, I mean, to accelerate yourself to other...
Like warp speed.
Yeah, warp speed. Well, I don't think there's warp speed, but, if you could just go near the speed of light, that would be a big help, because because sure. you could get to some star systems, the nearest one, in 8 years round trip. So that would be pretty cool. The question is how can you do that? And there are people are thinking about that. I don't know, you know, maybe doing preliminary experiments, but nothing really serious being developed. But there are ways of using antimatter, something called an ion drive, which is another technology. People trying to use solar sails, and they're playing around and exploring various ways of doing that. But so far, we don't have anything workable.
Will we be able to bend space and time? And reach those two points, let's say, like on a piece of paper, fold them together and the points hit?
Yeah, I don't know. Who knows? I mean, theoretically, to do that, you'd have to have, huge, dense masses to manipulate. And I don't know how, if you could take something the size of the sun and squeeze it down and bring it nearby and move it around, you could do that. But I don't know how you do that. But who knows? I mean, 100 years before the airplane, people wouldn't have thought you could fly Boeing 777 around the world either, right?
So true. Leonard, good luck with the book, The Upright Thinkers, okay?
Thanks, George. It's been fun.
Good to have you with us again. He has co-written a couple books with the physicist Stephen Hawking as well. Here's a little dose of real science. Up next, we're going to talk a little bit about metaphysical things, the paranormal, next on Coast to Coast AM. We will be right back.